from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Fraternities are not a small thing on many college campuses in this country. They're a big deal. Often, lately, a big problem. They're making headlines again. Gross, racist chants, pervy, peeping Tom Facebook pages, and on. Frats are too deeply embedded in our history to just go away, many will tell you. To others, they're incubators for too many problems to tolerate. This hour on Point, the stream of bad news out of this nation's frat houses lately. What's going on? What to do about it? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have frats gone wild lately? Were they always wild? Is this a case of just a few bad apples? Is there a better way? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor at The Atlantic. She spent a year researching fraternities and wrote about them at great and fascinating length in the magazine last year. Her article was headlined, "The Dark Power of Fraternities." You can find a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Caitlin Flanagan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me again.
You spent a year in there and came out talking about dark power. What do you mean by dark power?
Well, you know, I'd always wondered some of the questions you were asking in the intro. If they do, in fact, cause so many problems, why have they never been tamed? Why have they never been sort of brought to better behavior by the universities or by the general public? And the truth is, in all sorts of ways, they're very, very powerful institutions. I don't mean this in an inherently nefarious way, but their central tenets for existing at college campuses have to do with the constitutional rights of the young men. Their history at college campuses is largely responsible for why the American higher education system moved so rapidly across America in the late 19th and early 20th century. The housing they provided was instrumental. And so I realized that instead of thinking of them as sort of an extra addition to American higher education, they're an essential part of American higher education. And so getting rid of them is almost impossible. When people say, why don't colleges just get rid of them, you really can't. They're a deep part of the system. They're in the groundwater of higher ed.
We'll look at why that's the case and how that's the case, but these things keep happening. You have plenty of criticisms in your big piece, and it's a wonderfully written piece from a year ago, very relevant right now, but also a kind of respect there. When you look at the things that are going on, what is the dynamic that leads to, I mean, the things we now associate? Yes, you know, they talk about good works and philanthropy and training leaders and all the rest. And, you know, in my family, plenty of fraternity members, I get it. But the associations have become so much about alcohol and sexual assault and racial problems. What is the dynamic that is creating these incidents that lead to these headlines, Caitlin?
Well, when you look at the deep history of the fraternity movement, which was in the early 19th century, it was the beginning of the time when college wasn't just explicitly for religious training, which was why colleges began in America. It was when you first had kind of middle-class young men who were going off to business careers instead of to the ministry. And there was an idea then, as now, that for a lot of young men, college just isn't a great fit. There's a lot of sitting around in classrooms. There's a lot of writing these endless papers. There's a lot of expectations that your tremendous physical power and energy aren't really necessary. And the fraternity is the place that said, here's a parallel space within the college continuum where everything that doesn't fit in college fits beautifully. Being athletic, wanting to watch a lot of sports, wanting to hang out and drink and play, you know, in these days play, beer pong or foosball, that all these things aren't sort of marginalized and they're not frowned upon. They're the very center of our organization. And taken to extreme, a lot of those things will lead to bad behavior. But if you look in the history, fraternity houses were places where you could drink and campuses weren't. They were places where you could bring young women, oftentimes sex workers in the early history of fraternities. You certainly couldn't do that in an official dorm of a university. So there was always an idea that it was a space for, and fraternities don't like to admit this, but in their deep history, that in addition to having some sort of lofty ideals, it was a space for bad behavior to take place. And bad behavior in excess becomes terrible behavior.
Of course, it can go right off the charts terrible. Oklahoma saw that, responded to that so recently. Here's the tape, a very famous video. It came out of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, the University of Oklahoma's chapter there, now closed, and students out of the university on a chartered bus caught singing their racist chant.
There'll never be a thing. There'll never be a thing. You're hanging from a tree, but I'll never stop with me. There'll never be a
lynching and the N-word all in one chant. When that video came out, the university's president, David Bourne, former U.S. Senator and governor of Oklahoma, very quick to condemn, saying that racism would not be tolerated on his campus. Here he was last week talking to a crowd of students at a campus rally.
I have a message for those who have misused their free speech in this way. My message to them is, you're disgraceful. You have violated every principle that this university stands for.
Would he be glad if they were gone? You betcha, said David Boren.
Would I be happy if they left the university as students and were no longer our students? You betcha. I'd be happy. We don't have any room for racists and bigots at this university. I'd be glad if they left.
Caitlin Flanagan, in all kinds of instances where things get really hairy, you describe the legal backup for fraternities that has protected them over many years, kept them out of harm's way and from facing some of the most severe, even legal punishments.
Well, when you think about it, the famous saying in law school is that the Constitution doesn't end at the college gates, and that young men, certainly at a public university, have the right to freedom of association. It's an implied right from freedom of assembly. So people always say you should shut down these fraternities. You really can't do that. Young men have a right to belong to a private club. Just because they enrolled in college doesn't mean they can't belong to the Sierra Club. It doesn't mean they can't go to 7-Eleven. It doesn't mean they don't have a right to go to join clubs and to go places that they want to go. So when you get into fraternity issues, you very quickly get into constitutional issues. As for that repulsive chant, there are a lot of people saying, and I think they make a fine legal case, that, you know, you have a right to rent your own private bus and to go out and sit in it and say any vile thing you want to say. So to say that they should have been thrown out of the university for that, I think is questionable. I would say the larger issue is, why was that club all white, except for one exception, I think 10 or 12 years ago? Why has that club been all white for so long? And I think the underlying sentiments in that chant show you how they were admitting kids to their club. And given that we all support their club with federal tax dollars through their nonprofit status, and given that the university supports it in all kinds of ways through its Office of Greek Residence Life, I think it's really, really questionable that that club has been allowed to exist as an all-white club for so long.
Caitlin Flanagan, please stand by there in California. I want to bring Edward Shanahan into our conversation, founding president of Keystone Academy. It's a private pre-K through secondary school in Beijing. He dealt extensively with fraternities over the course of his career as a college administrator. He was dean of students at Wesleyan for 10 years, dean of the college at Dartmouth for another 10 years. Edward Shanahan, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
You, as a big dean, you wrestled with this for a long time. And the conclusion you've come down to, as I understand it, Ed, is that we really ought to just shutter the whole enterprise, that fraternities and universities are not ultimately a good match.
Well, let me begin, Tom, by saying that over the course of 20 years at two major universities, I had plenty of experiences with young men and young women in sororities. These were extraordinary individuals who contributed a great deal not only to the universities but to the Greek letter organizations that they were part of. It is true that these organizations provide a great deal of opportunity for leadership and service and philanthropy, as you've mentioned, as well as confidence building and friendships and lifelong university affiliations. They do provide that to many, many, and I would say most, of the men and women who are part of them. The question that I have, the concern that I have, is whether there is a structural dimension to the way these houses are organized that make them, in effect, a ticking time bomb for students who are part of the system, students who visit the system, a time bomb for their parents, for the universities, and for the national organizations. And the basis for that, in my judgment, is absenteeism.
Who's absent?
My sense, the alumni are absent, the faculty are absent, the nationals are absent. Presidents, by and large, President Roth notwithstanding, at Western University, absent, boards of trustees, absent. My feeling is that the alums are positioned only to defend these organizations without assuming any personal responsibility to be involved with them. The faculty are positioned, Tom, to condemn them, again, without any personal responsibility to be involved with them. The nationals, I think, are primarily concerned about protecting themselves and their assets and their investments. For presidents, it's the third rail. If a president came to me and said, Ed, should I take on the fraternities? I would say, at your peril. So we have, as I've described it, I tried to describe it, what in my judgment is a ticking time bomb on every college campus that hosts fraternities and sororities.
Usually if there's a ticking time bomb, you try and get it out of the building. Should fraternities and, I don't know, maybe sororities as well, Greek life, should it be gone?
I think that needs to be fundamentally restructured or gone. And by fundamentally restructured, I mean take them over, buy them out, if that's possible, and staff them appropriately so that there's some kind of adult supervision.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the stream of bad news, bad behavior, bad headlines out of fraternities lately, asking what's going on with Greek life, asking if it's time, possibly, maybe, to restructure or even banish Greek life from some, all American universities. It's on the table. You can join us this hour with all these headlines. What do you see going on? Are fraternities, Greek life, is it getting worse? Have they always had these issues? Is this a few bad apples problems, or is there something built into this system that goes to the dark side? What about the upside here? Of course, everybody references back. You know, it's not a new thing. Animal House, 1978, the movie. Dean at a fictional college. Dean Wormer wants to close down Delta Tau Chi fraternity because of their terrible academic standards and riotous behavior. Their reaction? Boone, played by Peter Riegert, and Otter, played by Tim Matheson, don't seem too intimidated.
One more slip up, one more mistake, and this fraternity of yours has had it at Faber.
Well, that was pleasant. Nice of him to stop by, don't you think?
We've got to do something. He's serious this time. I think he knows about the exams.
He's right.
You're right. We got to do something.
Absolutely.
You know what we got to do?
Toga party.
Animal House made it seem fun and funny. Lately, it hasn't seemed so fun. The Hunting Ground, a newly released documentary by Radius and CNN Films, is about sexual assault on college campuses. Includes allegations involved the SAE fraternity that was in the spotlight at Oklahoma and its culture. Here's a bit from the trailer for The Hunting Ground.
SAE, sexual assault expected.
The second most common type of insurance claim against the fraternity industry is for rape.
Her rapist's name matched the name of two other cases, and he was allowed back on campus.
The message is clear. You're not going to win.
The heat is on here, and the president of the University of Oklahoma, David Boren, again, not mincing words as he talked to a student body about racism at Sigma Alpha Epsilon SAE, saying they were not Sooners, as his students are called.
These people, as I said this morning, don't deserve to be called Sooners. They're misusing our name. Sooners are not racists and bigots. And as they pack their bags, I hope they think long and hard about what they've done.
Tough tone, tough language from President Boren there. Edward Shanahan is with us. He was dean of students at Wesleyan, was dean of the college at Dartmouth, has been deep in this for a long time, says restructure or let them be gone. Caitlin Flanagan spent a year in fraternity land for The Atlantic, wrote a terrific piece about it called The Dark Power of Fraternities. You can link to it at our website. onpointradio.org. She's with us today from Culver City, California. J. Patrick Biddix joins us from Tennessee. In one moment, a couple of calls first. Nick in Akron, Ohio. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. One thing that, I've been in a fraternity now for 4 years, my entire college experience.
Okay.
When you aired the clip about Animal House, it did kind of take me back to when I first came to campus. And I thought to myself, I don't want to be a part of something like that. And I didn't want to be a part of a fraternity when I got to my campus. And I was recruited into a fraternity system here in Akron, which is an amazing, amazing system where, as a community, we do strive to kind of take down those stereotypes time after time. And, what I was calling to talk about, the point is that, I was listening earlier about people calling in offense of the police. And I think one person said, 10 or 20% are these bad eggs that bring a bad image. Well, in fraternities, that percentage is a lot higher. But there still are really, really great chapters of fraternities all across the nation that are doing amazing things. But these men who fail to live up to the values that they pledge themselves to, and who fail to become better men and to make their brothers better men and to hold their brothers accountable to become better men, they're failing the rest of us.
What's at risk here, Nick, in your view? What's at risk? The heat is kind of on with all these headlines. Now, it's been on before, and fraternities roll on. But do you see something big changing?
My fraternity on a national scale switched to dry housing in 2001. And at Akron, it did take a while to implement this dry housing. And when I came through the fraternity system in 2011, we did switch, and we finally did make our house dry. And what happened was we saw our chapter membership go from 30 to 100 in 4 years. We saw our GPA go from about a 2.7 to a 3.05. And what? It's this idea that what is at risk is the very fabric of what our founders wanted to accomplish when all these organizations were founded hundreds of years ago.
Nick, I really appreciate your call. I've got more to get to, but I appreciate that. Caitlin Flanagan, a dry house, there's one alternative. Get the alcohol out. But you spend a year out there, that is hardly the status quo.
Well, I have to tell you, when I was listening to Nick talk and I was saying, wow, he sounds like a great kid, and then he mentioned the dry housing, I said, oh, he's a Phi Delta. The answer to all this problems has been solved by his fraternity, Phi Delta Theta. Over a decade ago, they said, you know what? We're not going to be a part of this anymore. If we're really going to lead, we're going to lead. And that means we're going to do a series of things. They took alcohol out of the house. They dropped out of the National Interfraternity Council. They no longer allow chapters to exist on campuses where the university has disaffiliated with them. They said, we're really going to take this problem seriously. And they are the absolute and undisputed leader in the fraternity industry. And I just smiled when I realized at the end, because I was like, what a great young man he is. And at the end, I realized, oh, he's a Phi Delta. When you hear someone speak from the heart about a really positive change in the fraternity industry, they are the leaders. And I think the rest are either going to fall in line with these true leaders, or they're going to see that their organizations are going to become increasingly irrelevant. And it's not, it's interesting. The president of the Phi Delta chapter at the University of Oklahoma is African American. When you really solve your problems, you start becoming a place that is more open to all sorts of students on the university. And that's the kind of America that we're living in now. It's a multi-ethnic, it's a multiracial, it's a very different university, a very different America than the one that so many of these clubs represent, which have rape in huge numbers. Racism is a joke to them. They love it. They love to have parties with racist themes. And I think they need to solve these problems or find themselves becoming completely irrelevant in a modern America.
And booze in general, it's hardly the exception.
No, that, you know, that's why Phi Delta got rid of it. I studied more liability claims than probably most people in the country outside of the fraternity industry itself and their insurance brokers. You do not find a hideous event in a fraternity house in which booze doesn't run right through it. And that's not unrelated to their problems with race and with having themselves be more open to African-American members. The lowest demographically, the students on campus who drink the least, who binge drink the least, are African-American students. And there's a reason for that. A lot of them come from communities where if you get involved with drugs and alcohol, America's answer isn't your mom and dad helps you out. America's answer is incarceration and total derailment. They are very rightly not attracted to organizations where kids are coming from such levels of privilege that they can drink themselves into oblivion, do all kinds of bad behavior, and people run in to rescue them. So again, the Phi Delta Theta answer, I say that's really the only answer I see that's going to save the system.
Caitlin Flanagan, Edward Shanahan, please stand by. J. Patrick Biddix joins us right now from Knoxville, Tennessee, professor of higher ed and coordinator of the College Student Personnel Program, Student Affairs at University of Tennessee at Knoxville, for a member of the Association of Fraternity Sorority Advisors, former editor of the organization's research journal. He was president of his fraternity, Beta Theta Pi, as a college student, went on to work for the International, was a house director at Ole Miss. J. Patrick Biddix, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What do you make of this tide of bad headlines lately, and not just lately? It seems like we've been marinating in this for a while now. Is something going wrong?
I want to say, first of all, I think I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to Caitlin for her article. It was extremely well written, and I think very much reveals some of the things that we need to be having conversations nationally about, and I'm glad that we're having those now. I think, by and large, nationally, fraternities and sororities, I would say as well, very much are committed to providing a home and a community for students when they arrive on college campuses. And I think that's fundamentally what they need to be doing. There's some longer-term benefits. There's some institutional benefits from ranging from leadership development to educational success. And, of course, alumni development is an institutional benefit. But I think, by and large, those are some of the benefits they certainly provide. And in midst of certainly deplorable acts and some of the more recent things that have come to light, but I think aren't necessarily isolated if you look at the long history, as Caitlin's pointed out, I think this offers us a time to really an opportunity to be educators within those groups. And that's where I would agree with several of the things that Edward brings up as well.
So how far would you go? I mean, I'm reading here in the Kansas State Collegian, an op-ed piece recently, saying Greek life has become nothing more than a cruel way to categorize and separate people based on looks, wealth, gender, and race. Their conclusion there is, let's abolish the whole system once and for all. What do you say, sir?
I don't think that's necessarily an answer. I think a lot of the problems that we see with fraternities and sororities are not fraternity sorority problems. They're 18 to 22-year-old developmental problems. What fraternities and sororities give us is an opportunity and a place to really address some of those things and to uplift members. And I think there certainly, as with any institution, whether it be college athletics or really companies, once we get out of college, we see these incidents and acts. I think that we have an opportunity with young men and women when they join, really to educate and to lift them up in such a way that can really better our society.
Edward Shanahan, what's your experience over time here of this ratio of uplift versus negative influence? Where do you come down after all your years of interacting with fraternities, Greek life?
I still, Tom, believe that these organizations are, as I mentioned earlier, time bombs. From a behavioral point of view, between the instinct and the act, there has to be a pause. And late adolescent boys are not generally good at exercising that pause. And put them together with a crowd of other late adolescent boys, and they're even less equipped to stop and think about what they're anticipating doing or saying. And the only way, in my judgment, around that is to have some other individuals integrated into the fabric of the houses.
Which most do not now, right? There's no adult in most of these houses whatsoever.
Most do not now. I want to be quick to say that I really appreciate Nick's comments, because in my judgment, the vast majority of boys in fraternities and girls in sororities get an enormous amount out of their experience. It is the 20% or the 15%, and the problem with the 20 or 15% is that is going to be endemic to the institution itself as long as there's the lack of supervision, free flow of alcohol, access to women, and Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night.
Ray in North Kingston, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Many, many years ago, I was president of a fraternity, and I would never allow any kind of abuse to women. I took measures to protect women during, you know, parties and things like that. And I just have to think that today's problem stems from a lack of maturity and a sense of entitlement of young men that they can do anything they want. And, you know, what fraternities need is leadership and internal policing to end this kind of abuse. It's pretty simple. You have to have mature people at the leadership helm who will who are not afraid to take measures to stop this kind of.
But Ray, if that's not showing up, and we look at all these headlines, and you can get the impression that it is not sufficiently showing up, then what? And you know, there are years and years and years of experience here now. What's to be done?
Well, I maybe it's getting some adults involved. If there's a lack of leadership and a lack of internal policing and an immaturity and a sense of entitlement throughout the fraternity, then that can't be allowed.
I appreciate your call, Ray. Caitlin, what do you say? A sense of entitlement, lack of maturity, something different going on today than in years past? And what about, you know, bringing the leadership, bringing the internal policing? Who's going to do that, if anyone?
All good questions. And, I was listening to the voices, and I thought, you know, as the one woman on the show, I do have to speak up for the many, many, many thousands of women who have been raped in these houses over the years. And I'm 53 now, so I went to college over three decades ago. And we girls in college, we were talking about this rape that was going on. We didn't even have a language for it yet. The concept of date rape was only I went to college in the mm-hmm. South. It was only beginning to be born in the northern colleges. But we looked at those houses. They were so big, so powerful, so august. You know, they had really beautiful fraternity houses where I went to college. And the thought that there was so much power there, and they were such pride was taken in those fraternity houses by our university. And, you know, that our university president would show up and have, you know, sherry at these houses. And there was this idea that our university thought it was okay for there to be these places where our friends had been raped. And if you told me then as a girl, 19 years old, that I'd be an adult, I'd be 53, my friends would be sending daughters to these colleges, and the rape problem, if anything, was worse, I would have been shocked. And I do have to stand up and say, I know that there are women listening today who either were assaulted in fraternity houses or who had friends who were. And I think it's a real national black eye that our hall, you know, that we have federal tax breaks. We have so many tax breaks for an organization so deeply involved in sexual assault. And what went on at Penn State, you know, photographs of young women nude and passed out from alcohol being, you know, available to be sexually acted upon. I mean, this is vile. This is uncivilized behavior.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the bad news, bad headlines coming out of fraternities lately, asking what is going on with Greek life, asking if it's time for fraternities to shape up in a big way, to change in a big way, to go, to be out of the American college environment. Edward Shanahan is with us. He was dean at Wesleyan University, at Dartmouth. A lot of experience here. He's not so sure this is going to work. J. Patrick Biddix is with us. A long experience with fraternities. He says the benefits outweigh the downside, but we're in a period of problems here. And Caitlin Flanagan, who wrote about this, she spent a year in fraternities for The Atlantic, came out with a powerful piece called The Dark Power of Fraternities. You can read or link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Penn State, as Caitlin was just saying, Kappa Delta Rho, created a private Facebook page posting photos of unconscious women, some of them nude, posed sexually, students going in there, alums going in there to look at this stuff. Earlier this week, Penn State senior Carolyn Dudley told CBS News about what went on at the parties, the photos taken by frat guys.
Drinking definitely got out of hand. They never really ran out of alcohol, so they're like encouraging everyone to drink, whether you seemed like you could handle it or not.
Are you angry about it?
You're jeopardizing these girls' reputations. Also, you're embarrassing them and their families.
NPR's affiliate WPSU talked to students at Penn State.
I think there's probably a lot more stuff that's just kind of kept under the covers.
I have a lot of friends that are in fraternities, and they have all said that they think it's ridiculous. They'd never do anything like that. So I don't think it's some. I hope that people don't take it as all frats are like these disgusting people that like do this, you know?
I was shocked, a bit disgusted. I think it gives us a bad name.
And after the racist chanting at the University of Oklahoma, we had Blaine Ayers, national director for the fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon, apologizing for racist behavior and saying that's not the way.
I want to start my remarks today by saying that the recent actions of certain members at the University of Oklahoma do not reflect the fraternity I now lead. The chant in the video is ugly. It is demoralizing and absolutely counter to the values of SAE.
SAE, but we got CNN coming out with his documentary where they're saying SAE, sexual assault expected. Meredith in New Haven, Connecticut. Meredith, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. So I went to Purdue University. It has a really large Greek system.
Yeah.
And I was out of state student going there, not knowing anybody. I joined the sorority, and it was a really neat way to make friends when you have a really large university like that. My husband was in a fraternity there as well. And it's my opinion that these are bad seeds. And a lot of the people who write the reports aren't in fraternities. They weren't in sororities. They're not Greek. They don't understand. They don't write anything good about all the philanthropy that the fraternities and sororities do and all the money that they raise for local, you know, different local philanthropies around the area and how they really help shape the university's city and where they are. You never see good articles written. All you ever see are the bad ones.
Why would that be, Meredith?
I'm not sure. I think bad headlines make better news or better, you know, just make for better news. And you never really see the good stuff come out of the fraternities and sororities.
What's your reaction to Caitlin Flanagan pointing to, you know, the volume of rape that has gone on over years in fraternities and the implications of that?
I think it happens university-wide, not necessarily in the fraternities. I think they're pointed out just because it's a fraternity house. It's where all men are housed. But I'm sure it happens all around the campuses, which is very unfortunate. I think it's a bigger issue for universities, but I wouldn't point the finger at fraternities and the Greek life in general.
Meredith, I appreciate your call. Caitlin, you do point out at some length the philanthropy and the public work that fraternities and sororities do around the country. What about Meredith's assertion that this isn't a fraternity problem when it comes to sexual assault or rape? It's a general campus problem.
Well, I would say that this is something I often hear is why do you report the bad things? Why don't you report the many good things? And my answer to that is because the bad things we're talking about are absolutely egregious. It's not as though the problems at fraternities are the grade point is a little low and the house is a little messy and the party's a little loud. We're talking about kids who are getting seriously injured or killed through the inflicted trauma of hazing. We're talking about kids dying of alcohol poisoning. We're talking about rape and sexual assault of all kind to women and men in these houses. And we're talking about a system that has a really ugly track record record for racial problems. And, you know, the issue in Oklahoma when the head of the SAE comes out and says that chant doesn't reflect who we are, I would question that. And chapter after chapter after chapter of SAE, it is all white. So I think that there is something in the membership there that is not particularly welcoming to young African-American men. And I say, you know, as a mother of two boys who are almost ready to go to college, I'm white, my kids are white. I imagine, what would it be like to be the mother of an African-American son at the University of Oklahoma? You know, you send your kid off to college, you've got so much hope, you've got so much pride. But as a mother, the number one thing you're thinking is, he's leaving home. He's going from this place he's been loved and admired. Will he find friends? Will he be accepted? Will he have mentorship? And to think that you've sent your son to a school where there's an officially recognized club that he can't even approach for friendship because his skin is black? I mean, this is 2015. So don't tell me it doesn't reflect your values when chapter after chapter of SAE is, to use the old phrase, lily white. It can't be a coincidence.
J. Patrick Biddix, what about that simple fact and what it says about racial attitudes within this particular fraternity organization?
I don't think I could necessarily comment on a particular fraternity organization or what I want to. I think I would point to the United States as having a history of race problems, not a single fraternity having those problems. Certainly, I think also higher education has gotten to a point now that we very much are, I think, committed to having conversations about race and ethnicity and gender and a number of other things that in the past we've really shied away from. And so I think as we continue to grow and understand how we should be educating our students and ourselves along these issues, it's going to take quite a commitment to get us there. I don't think it's an oversimplified problem that we can oversimplify.
Ed Shanahan, do fraternities help us toward the promised land here or slow down that progress toward inclusion, acceptance, diversity?
I think for the vast majority of members of those houses that it moves them forward and provides something that's important for them both as they're growing up and in later life. But as I've said, I think the risks associated endemic to the structure of these houses just creates enormous risk for parents and for universities. I ask myself, because I believe that, as I mentioned earlier, for our presidents, it's the third rail to attack fraternities or try to do something significant with them. I ask myself, where are the boards of trustees who can have capital campaigns to raise millions upon millions of dollars? Where are the boards of trustees who initiating a campaign to fix this problem at a couple of universities to provide models for others? Places like Amherst and Williams addressed these issues years ago, and they're by and large better universities as a result of that. I also ask myself, Tom, where are the insurance companies? Why don't insurance companies set standards for houses that go along the lines of protecting young people from falling out windows, over-consuming alcohol? In my judgment, it's not until the pocketbooks of universities are affected by this that we're going to see substantive change.
So when you say risk, you're really talking about financial risk more than moral or ethical.
No, I'm talking about it all. It's financial risk, it's reputational risk, and that touches on the moral dimensions of this.
Caitlin, there has been a powerful kind of legal bulwark against lawsuits here, but there's been big business suing fraternities.
It has, and when we ask the question of where are the insurance companies, nowhere, because the fraternities self-insure. You know, they were at a point in the early 80s when insurer after insurer after insurer told the fraternities, you guys are nuts, you can't go on this way anymore, and tore up their policies. And the fraternity industry realized, we are all going to need to band together, pool our risk, and create a vast fund of money, which they have done, and we're going to have to pay out on our own claims. So in a certain extent, we're not going to see that ever be a pushback, because they'll just, if your chapter has a lot of problems, your dues goes up, the dues go straight to fraternity risk management fund, and when there are problems, the fraternity industry will pay out on the problems. So a lot of the checks and balances that would exist in another kind of industry organization, they simply don't exist.
What about alums and boards of trustees, Caitlin?
You know, it's always interesting. If you look at the boards of trustees at colleges and universities, a lot of wealthy people are on them. And if you track back to the men on those, a lot of them belonged to a fraternity while they were in the college or the university. And they're much more likely to talk about reforming that system in some vague way than they are to getting rid of the system. So I always say that one of the reasons that the essay was called The Dark Power is the power of these men is real. They tend to go on into the powerhouse fields of law, business, and politics. And to me, the most chilling thing about that Oklahoma video wasn't the N-word itself. It was, what are those men going to grow up to be? You know, they're not going to grow up to be, you know, painters somewhere. They're going to grow up to, you know, or artists. They're going to grow up and probably be the DA, probably be involved in law enforcement or in business. And when they go to hire or to prosecute, is there something in their mind that's unexamined and unexplored, but that comes with racial bias? I would say if you're chanting that on a bus, there may well be that. So I think these are things that deserve our exploration.
But what's wrong if the Board of Trustees says, let's look at reform here? Maybe that's exactly the right path. What's wrong with a reform-minded attitude when these problems emerge?
Because the fraternities are going to say, we are private organizations. You can kick us off campus if you want, but you don't have the right to change the way we do business. We are a private club. So you get into really difficult territory. University doesn't have a lot of power over them. The only power they have is to break their formal association. And at campus after campus, you'll find that when you break the official relationship with the university, now you have a fraternity with no oversight whatsoever by the university. And then you really get into the so-called gang with money situation many times, which we saw happen this spring at American University in Washington, D.C. You had an unaffiliated fraternity that was all but jumping in members to their club. So it's a deep, deep problem, and there are no easy answers to it.
Kyle in New Orleans, Louisiana. Kyle, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was calling to talk about the Facebook thing. I find it kind of interesting. I have a young brother who's about to graduate high school, and he's planning on going to college, and in turn, he wants to join a fraternity.
Okay.
And I think what a big part of this is the social media, it's promoting this kind of bad behavior, and these high school kids are seeing it, and they're like, oh, well, I want to do that. You know, I don't have rules. I don't have this. And, you know, you're getting all these organizations kind of making money off of this idea, and in turn, it's their priorities are kind of messed up when they're going into these colleges to join fraternities.
So expectations coming in set by what people have seen in social media, which may not be the ideal lure here. J. Patrick Biddix, what about it? How social media has changed things, the message that's going out. Are people joining fraternities for the right reasons these days, the kind of philanthropy and leadership building experience that you focus on?
Well, let me speak first from a research perspective, which is more so where my interests lie in this, at least my expertise, I should say. Often, when we look at many of the problems associated with membership, and I'll speak specifically about binge drinking and sexual assault as two of the major, certainly, mm-hmm. we see that membership, many of those members came in with pre-existing behaviors. So a lot of times when they get to college, many of those members, in fact, the majority, have had those experiences in high school and brought that into college. And so I think one of your first things is a recruitment issue. I think fraternities sell a certain value, and then I think we generate and get members that don't necessarily live up to those same expectations. And that, in turn, creates a system. And recruitment is one of those things that you can't rest on. We see the same thing in graduate recruitment. When we want to bring in the best and brightest, we can't make a concerted effort 1 year and expect they'll continue to come the next year after mm-hmm. year after year.
Mm-hmm. But are fraternities drawing the right membership then? Or, you know, our caller in New Orleans says, you know, his brother is looking at social media. He's seeing a lot of party activity, and that's what's drawing him potentially to the fraternity life, not high-flown messages about leadership.
I think it's certainly an appeal, certainly to an 18 to 19-year-old to come in and have an environment with a lot less supervision, certainly, and the ability to make what decisions that you want to make without supervision, without oversight, and certainly without, initially it looks like, without a lot of consequence. However, I do think that that's where fraternities in some cases are selling themselves short. There are tremendous opportunities for leadership and development. In fact, I would argue that at this point in time, this is one of the greatest times we've ever had for developing young men with fraternity programming. I'm talking about more nationally at this point. And so I don't have a lot of hesitation in sending my sons through a fraternity thinking about that now. Now, mine are very young. We're a far cry from when they'll be able to do that. But I think the ability, the opportunities that they'll get to engage are pretty tremendous. And I'm actually more excited about this time than I would have been in any other time in our history.
Ed Shanahan, do you see a reform movement afoot here? These are big institutions with a lot of history and a lot of membership right now, but also some rough headlines all over the place. Do you see change coming yet?
I don't see reform coming without a strong impetus from outside of universities. I'm pleased that the Phi Delts are taking the bull by the horn and correcting and providing a model for certain houses. But I think this wave of heinous activity is going to subside, and everybody will go back to the new normal. And 5 years from now, we're going to read about another sexual assault or a gang rape or, God forbid, the death of a fraternity member or a guest.
5 years from now sounds like 5 years from now sounds like it might be good if you could have that big a gap. Caitlin, do you see change?
I don't see change, no.
The American way? Maybe this is it.
I think so.
Maybe
think
this is
so.
It. Caitlin Flanagan has written about it in great detail. Terrific piece, The Dark Power of Fraternities. It's in The Atlantic. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Caitlin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
J. Patrick Biddix at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Edward Shanahan, thanks for joining us today, Ed.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.